All right, let's do a proverb, shall we? 25, 20. And then when we get into Exodus. Jeez. 25:20. Read that. Nope. No James. Whoever. Just read that. Did everyone hear me say James? Wow. Maybe I did. Maybe I'm speaking in tongues. Can anybody interpret tongues? Because then I would be in sin if no one could. There you go. Perfect. That's what I meant. That's what I meant to say. Proverbs 25:20.
Whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day and like vinegar on soap.
All right, so mine arrangement's a little bit different. Like one who takes off a garment on a cold day. What happens when you take off a garment on a cold day? You get cold and you shrivel, right? So you shake and you shrivel, okay? Like vinegar on soda, the idea is if you put something acidic on something basic, right, it shrivels, it renders each useless. So vinegar on soda, I don't do that every day, so most of you probably don't either. I have no idea what that means, right? But the idea is it's the same as part A, is it makes the substances shrivel, okay? They get smaller. Is he who sings songs to a troubled heart? What's that mean? What's the context there? What does it mean to sing songs to someone with a troubled heart? Yeah, absolutely. So you've got someone that has a troubled heart who's hurting, right? And you're saying the wrong thing, right? Whatever it is, it's the wrong thing. The idea is you are unsympathetic to where they are at in life, right? They're going through something that is painful or difficult or whatever it is, and you don't have the ability to empathize with them and say, man, I bet that's difficult. I bet what you need to hear or what you don't need to hear is this, and obviously the end result is what happens to that person as a result of that careless or unsensitive person? What are they doing to that person? Causing them to shrivel, right? It's not helpful. You're making the situation worse by saying words that are not appropriate for the circumstance, right? Yes, ma'am. Oh, boy, I don't know, Callie. This is very early. It's always good. I just don't know the answers. It could, yeah, I think.
Vinegar and baking soda, when you put it, that's like what you do to make a volcano. It like fizzes and gets all
shit. Yeah, that's right. Seventh grade earth science, I recall that, with lots of colors. I don't know. Callie, you go try it today and report back.
No, I've done it before. It definitely does that, so I'm wondering if that adds to it at all.
Explosive combination.
Natron?
Yeah. I don't even know what that is. Sodium carbonate is what they put in. That's bicarbonate. Never mind. All right. Sodium bicarbonate is stuff that's in soda, right?
Like a mineral salt found in dried lake
beds. Let's just bring it to mind. That would be Dead Sea, so that would be appropriate.
So would that make sense? So it would cause them either to like withdraw or explode?
Maybe that's the meaning of the part B. Somebody go dig in that and find out for me. So go do some research. I want to know. So regardless, the response is wrong, right? The person's not being attentive to the needs of the other. So why would we bring this up in here? There's a consistent pattern with folks that go into ministry that are social workers, nurses, paramedics get this way. They see so much pain in the world from people that it's very easy to become insensitive to those things, to turn it off and to get jaded, right? And just to be like, listen, I've seen so many wrecked marriages that you get fed up with it. You get tired of dealing with people in your office that won't quit doing stupid and quit wrecking their marriage. It's like, it's not that difficult. Like, quit being an idiot and don't do that, right? And on a bad day, when you see the pain and the people continuing to wreck their ships on the rocks of life, per se, you can just get jaded to that, right? When you see pain, like nurses, and you watch folks that have to deal with people that inflict pain on themselves, and they end up dealing with doctors and nurses and paramedics and the like, the end results of it, it gets painful. A good friend of mine that was instrumental in helping kind of form the well at the very, very beginning is a paramedic. And you could just hear some of the things when he had to go see the same patients over and over and over again. And it was the same thing, and they would not quit doing it. It just, you get jaded towards the world. So a caution to all of us that are going to be in those worlds. And you guys are in that now, right? As you're dealing with junior high girls, right? You think they have issues, and sometimes you're like, really? Like, are you like, this is your life, and this is what you're stressing about, or whatever it may be. And it's hard sometimes to put ourselves in that situation, but you're going to be there. And what that person needs more often than not is someone that has a sympathetic ear that can say, man, I am sorry. That must be incredibly painful. I do not have the answers to your problems. I don't know why you're going through what you're going through. How about Job's friends, the ones that did the best job? What did they do for Job in his moment of just pain? They were just there, right? They were just present. The guys that were idiots were the guys that tried to theologically solve all of Job's problems and were wrong and unsympathetic. He just needed someone that was with him, okay? And again, I think we've said it before, but 90% of that is just showing up. Be there with people that are hurting. You don't need to have the answers. You just need to know. We talked about that with the Rumleys. Just be there and be present, okay? So if you see your tracks going down those roads in terms of you're going to deal with people's lives and the wreckage and the carnage sometimes that comes out of them, I can only imagine as a lawyer some of the stuff that you probably see. It's probably, you know what I mean? Like, you just get in life on life with people, and after a while, you lose sensitivity to that, and that can't happen in ministry, okay? You've got to stay sympathetic to those things, and it can be difficult at times.
I mean, I can see it also where, like, you just don't have the right words to say. Like, you are sympathetic and you try to maybe spin it and make it a little more look on the bright side.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that I hear a lot of those stories, and I was really convicted by one the other day. We were we had a gal in our office that wrote a really good blog on infertility, right? And she talked about all the wonderful, godly, good-meaning people that just say stupid things when they're struggling with infertility. And they're sympathetic, or they're at least trying to be, but they just don't know what to say. So instead, they say stuff that they shouldn't. And I was thinking through, we're going to walk through a gal's story in 1 Samuel. That's her life is kind of enveloped in the fact that she can't have a kid, right? It's Hannah with Samuel, right? And I remember teaching that, thinking, man, was I sympathetic to the fact that there are people in the room that are currently wrestling with that issue, you know? So, and I've been one to, you know, I've said plenty of stupid things. So I think that's often a big cause as well. People don't know what to say, so they try to say stuff. I sat with a gal weeks ago that lost her husband in a bike accident, right? He was a guy that I rode with like once a week for years. And same thing, like they're trying to say, gosh, I'm really sorry that you've lost your husband. I know how hard that is. And they would just say dumb things. And if you get people together that have been through that, the stories that they can share about the stupid things that people have said are amazing. So more often than not, the best thing you can do is shut your mouth and just be there and love on people and hug them and love them. And can I bring you a chicken pot pie? Or, you know, can I go mow your yard? Like, what do you need right now that I want to meet real tangible needs? And again, like, some of you are far better at this than I am, right? That have that harmonizer side of you. I get like, I don't know what to do either. So this is not a strong gifting of mine. It's not something that comes natural to me. So I've had to learn the hard way. I'm sticking my foot in my mouth. That's a great observation. So, but just recognize that you're going to have tendencies to get there. And if you start feeling your jaded meter rise, take a break. Figure out what you need to do to re-energize, because you're going to be around pain like that often, okay? And you've got to tuck the stories away that are the home run, life change, like, this is what happened. Like, keep those around and keep those close to you, because that'll be fuel to your fire, because you're probably going to see a lot more people do stupid, or you're going to hear about those than you are some of the great life-changing stories. And they're there, but sometimes those aren't the ones that end up in our office just to say, you're doing a great job. I love you. Thanks for just being you. And you just, those don't always come to the forefront. So, okay. So, by the way, that's the root of like homesickness, right? Everyone around you has no idea what you're going through. You're longing for home and they're all happy to be where they're at. They're not sympathetic to what you need. Suicide rate skyrockets during Thanksgiving and Christmas. because everyone else around you is happy because they have family and everything's great, and you're miserable and nobody can feel what you're going through. They're looking forward to the holidays, and you're not because you have no one to spend it with or whatever it may be, right? So I was talking to a pastor on staff that last year and this year, because he doesn't have family in town, he's having those people over. That's his Thanksgiving. I don't have family, you don't have family, let's be a family and we'll have Thanksgiving together. I'm like, man, good for you, right? You care about the folks that just otherwise may have just been overlooked and no one would have cared to even ask, because I have family to go hang out with. So in fact, y'all can have my family sometimes. So I want to be by myself. So anyway, so. Oh. No, we're Central Texans are just as bad. So that's me and my family. So, oh yeah. So no, they're great. We have our moments as introverts that we just want alone time. So, thoughts on that? Any of you guys wrestle with that? Seen that? Foresee that? Does he affectionately say something about something? Is that what?
He says it's both and. So he says being insensitive and unsympathetic does much harm. It's useless and causes a violent reaction. So it's both like the garment, the cold weather thing. So it causes people to withdraw, but also it can cause them to explode.
Interesting. I like it. So that's the vinegar on soda thing.
Yeah.
See, Callie was right once again. So there you go. Perfect. Good to know. Okay. I will make a note. All right. Cool. All right. Exodus, shall we? You believe we're done with Genesis? All right, so let's do this. Let's quickly review Genesis. I want you guys, no notes, walk me through it. And then we'll kind of give you an overview of Exodus as best I can. Perfect. All right, so two big divisions of Genesis are what? Planks and patriarchs, right? Okay. Planks are what? What chapters? 1 through 11, and then 12 through 50 are the patriarchs, right? Okay, so let's walk through the planks. Plank 1 was God, which was chapter what? 1. Chapter 2 is man. Chapter 3 is sin. 3:15. Redemption. Okay. 4 and 5. This is always when people are like, civilizations. Okay. 6 through 9. Noah, judgment, good, okay. And then 10, 11, and 12. Nations, races, religions. Nations, races, pagan religions, okay? There it is. That's 1 through 11, okay? You got it? Okay. Patriarchs. First patriarch was Abraham, who was 11 through 24, 25, somewhere in there, right? Okay, then who was next? Isaac, who got the short story, a couple chapters, okay? Who's Isaac's kid? Jacob, who gets the lion's share of the story. And then who's the last guy? Joseph or Judah's the promised line. Okay, there you go. That's Genesis. And the theme is sovereign election. Okay, so let's do the same with Exodus, shall we? I'll give you guys kind of a simple breakdown. Okay, so theme of Exodus is redemption or... I'll give you a deliverance. Okay, because if you've seen Prince of Egypt, you're singing the song, deliverance, right? Okay, so either one is acceptable. So I usually go with deliverance. That's the idea, okay? Three kind of big picture breakdowns in Exodus as well. Dude, I don't know how musicians do this chord thing. Like I'm always, it's like when I get distracted and I watch people worship, I'm like, how does Sam not step on that chord when he leads worship? Because all I can do is step on the chord when I'm talking. So, all right. So chapters 1 through 11, okay, we're going to be looking at Israel's subjection. Okay, they are in Egypt, right? We learn that chapter 1 is going to occur over about 400 years, okay? From chapter 2 to basically 1521, that's going to be another 80. Okay? Sorry, I did those backwards.
What, you said Genesis?
Did I?
No.
James? What? Proverbs? Huh? Chapter 1.
Oh.
Chapter 1 of... now you got me doing it. Of Exodus Okay? 400 years. 2 through 21, 1521, we're going to still be in Egypt. It's going to cover another 80 years. Okay? So by the time we got to chapter 1, we've covered a ton of ground. Okay? So that's kind of the idea. In chapter 12, we're going to see God now deliver his people. Okay? And he's going to spend some time discipling them. Israel's discipleship. Okay? However you want to label that. 12 through 18. Okay? Is a good breakdown. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Well, behind today, does that say chapter 2 through 15?
Yeah. 2 through 15, 21.
Yeah. Okay, got it.
With me?
Yeah.
You can't read my doctor's handwriting? Shame on you. Okay. All right. And then 19 through the end of the book, through chapter 40, we're going to see Israel's revelation. God will reveal to them the law. The last half of the book is the building of the tabernacle and the commands and prohibitions and the law. So we'll see a ton of that, okay? High priest and a lot of that stuff, okay? So, makes sense? So that's big picture. And again, this is a great example of, you can call these whatever the heck you want to, okay? So, subjection, discipleship, revelation, I mean, that's all up for grabs. So as you guys begin to think through charting on your own, what I want you guys to feel is the big picture breakdown, okay? And there's even other ways to kind of to break down the book, okay? A natural way to break it down would also be through, like, chronology. So if we took, let's do this. If we took this concept and said here to here is 480 years, there's another way to look at it, okay? Through 1521. You with me? Okay, in the end of the book, basically from there to the end of the book is 3 months. How about that? Okay, so they're going to be at Mount Sinai. They're going to arrive at Mount Sinai in 1521, and they're going to sit there while God gives them all the commands. Okay, and we'll see a little bit of history, but all in all, we see 3 months pass by. Okay, I'm sorry, till 19:2. My bad. And then we get 1 year. I done lied to you. Okay, and they sit at Mount Sinai for a year. Okay, so 11 months. Okay? Am I totally confusing you? Okay, so chapter 1, okay, through 1521. 480 years, okay? From 1522 to 1902 is a three-month journey to Mount Sinai, okay? So they hit Mount Sinai here, sorry. Okay? They will sit at Mount Sinai from 1902 until the end of the book for a year, okay? Make it a sense? More better-er? Okay? If you're like really picky, it's actually 11 months. And just because you guys are being very exacting, and Callie's going to ask me after she studies it tomorrow. Okay? Okay? And if you want to be really, really picky, they're not going to move from the base of Mount Sinai until Numbers chapter 10. So they're going to sit there through Leviticus, okay? And then into Numbers, they're going to sit there, and then God's going to say, okay, we built the tabernacle. Now I'm going to show you guys how to move, and they're not going to move from that place until God blows the whistle, and then they are going to head out, and God's going to show them how to camp and all that stuff, okay? So it's not until Numbers chapter 10 that they leave that place. So they're there for 11 months until Numbers chapter 10, okay? You feel me? All right. Well, let's jump in. We'll start kind of making some observations together. Look at the beginning of Moses' life, okay? Pretty fascinating. As we see this guy, we don't get a ton on his first 80 years, but his last 40 are pretty important, okay? And his first 80, I would say, are very important as well. They're just, we don't get a ton of detail in the scripture, okay? Thankfully, we get a little bit more in Acts from our boy Stephen, okay? So let's pick up Exodus. Let's just do Genesis again, shall we? We looked at this last week. We looked at chapter 1 a bit. So we saw, obviously, the recounting of the tribes and who made it into Egypt. Joseph dies. Jacob is dead. The problem was what? What do we see in verse 8? We got a new Pharaoh in town, right, who did not know Joseph, didn't care about his works. No, in the sense that he didn't have a firsthand knowledge. He got it, you know, obviously, after the fact. And he doesn't have that, he's not thankful to the degree because of, obviously, he doesn't know what Jacob or what Joseph had done to save his world. Okay, problem is in verse 9 and following. Again, Israelites are breeding like crazy. Okay, so we're going to see that again. They're going to leave town with 1.5 million ish people. Okay, maybe upwards of 3 million. They're going to be on that Exodus journey. So we're going to see a lot of folks. So Pharaoh says, "Hey, we need to deal wisely with them." In verse 10, we're going to make them slaves to us because if there's a day that we end up in battle with them, they're going to be able to outdo us. So we cannot do that, okay? Verse 11, they appointed taskmasters over them to put them into difficult labor. They built for Pharaoh storage cities, okay? So they're storing up grain and other things in verse 11. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and the more they spread out. So they were the dread of the sons of Israel. They were in dread of the sons of Israel. Isn't that fascinating? Do we see that happen in the early church as well? What happens when persecution comes to the church? They spread, right? They thrive in persecution. What happens to Israel when Egypt puts their thumb on them? They continue to thrive and do better. So often we see that as backwards and don't see as that maybe is the plan of God, but sometimes through persecution and difficulty is when we tend to thrive, okay? So 13 and following, let's pick up there. So I'm going to read in 13 and following. Anyone ever laid brick before? There's not a task, blue-collar stuff, that is more difficult than laying brick. It is really, really difficult work. So as you're building pyramids, as you're building cities, this was not easy. This was back-breaking labor, right? So you guys have seen...
The weather there, too.
Yeah, a little warm, yeah. Right? Yeah, not a comfortable place to be. So this would have been very, very difficult, right? So you get the idea, okay? So Pharaoh, verse 15, has an idea. So he speaks to one of the Hebrew midwives and says, here's what we're going to do. Verse 16, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it's a daughter, then you shall let them live. So what was his idea? Kill all the boys, so what can't they do? We're going to breed out the population, right? So it's sad, but this is... unfortunately, a significant piece of Israel's history, right? They got it in Egypt. Fast forward to the Holocaust. This is a very touchy and delicate subject. As a result of this is consistently part of their history. What's even more sad, we're going to go visit, by the way, the Holocaust Museum, okay, in Israel, and it is, you talk about I've been through it once. I don't know that I'll go through it again, right? It's kind of like watching the Passion of the Christ. You're like, okay, I saw it. I understand it. You know, that's not something you just turn on for Friday night for a feel-good, warm movie, okay? It's good for you to go through, and you guys need to hear modern Israeli history, which is what Ronan will give you guys. It's a fascinating place, but it is gut-wrenching. It is really, really difficult to see. There are countries today that have never heard of the Holocaust. Ronan would bring in tours from Japan. Never heard of the Holocaust. Like, doesn't exist. We're talking about upwards of 6 million Jews that were killed, right? And it's amazing that even Germany, sometimes in their history, will deny the fact that it even happened. Like, that was, Israel's making it up. It's a farce. It's like the whole, like, we didn't really send someone to the moon. That was all a joke, right? But there's people that today, and there are Korea and tons of countries that don't teach it. People don't know about it. We're astonished by that in our schools because we at least have heard of it and know about it and don't take it as like, that couldn't be true. So it's insane. So as you walk through there and see the significance of it. In Israel, there's a really good job of remembering their people and making sure that they don't forget. It's part of the reason why they are as bold and confident as they are today. And as you read about them in the news, they kind of have a, excuse the phrase, but kind of a middle finger mentality of the world. It's like, look, we're going to do what we're going to do, and we're going to protect ourselves come hell or high water. Like, you know, I don't care what the UN says or, you know, what our president may be saying about whatever situation. They're going to fight for themselves, and they are a diligent and really, really neat people. So, but anyway, unfortunately, this is a part of their history and always has been. So you can imagine the pain and the difficulty that would come out of that, right? So every boy dies, okay? So now, thankfully, verse 17, the midwives feared God, did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them. The king calls to them and says, why have you let the boys live? This is funny. Verse 19, we need a woman to read that.
The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive.
Right. The Egyptian women, they're sissies. They don't, you know, the Hebrew women, they, you know, they crank out a baby and then they go get back to work or whatever. So it's like they're vigorous, right? So for whatever reason, God uses that logic to persuade Pharaoh not to kill the midwives or what have you, okay? If we have sissy women, they do not. They're vigorous, right? So God was good to the midwives and the multitude of the people. They became very mighty, came about as a result of that, that he established households for them. Verse 22, Pharaoh now has another idea. Every son who was born, you were to cast into the Nile. Every daughter, you were to keep alive. So if we can't get them before they're dead or on the birth stool, then we'll simply throw them into the river. Okay, so pretty hard guy, right? I mean, when you're willing to kill an entire population of people. And again, it's a great example of worst case scenario thinking, right? This guy is panicked about what could happen and decides that that's the best case scenario, okay? So we're going to kill now a whole new generation of people, okay? So there's 400 years. So from Joseph's death now to Moses and him coming on the scene in chapter 2, we've seen now 400 years of history, okay? So 2 verse 1, we're going to get another family.
Would those midwives have been Egyptian?
It says they were Hebrew midwives, yeah? 15, yeah.
Okay.
So, yep. So again, which is why they feared God, okay? So odd question in Scripture that you hear all the time, is it okay to lie? Are there times that it's appropriate? So they lie to Pharaoh, and God does what? Honors it, right? How about Rahab and the spies? Where are the spies? Oh, they left. They went that way. Like they're hiding in the roof, right? They're underneath the straw roof. God honors it, right? Y'all figure that one out. That's a fun Friday night debate. So does God honor lying at times? And in several times in Scripture, he seems to say, that was a better answer, right? Given your choices, like that sucked and that sucked, that was better. That was, you know, so I don't know. So you guys figure that out. Now, again, I can point out 2, maybe 3 instances in Scripture where you see that. So I don't recommend lying ever, but there are times that you see, like when push comes to shove, they say, you know what? No, we're not gonna kill a kid. No, I'm not gonna give up the spies. So there's a good seminary debate. These are the things that seminarians will. You'll see a fight in a cafeteria, you know, at Western over something like this. What? No, not a bunch of persisters going crazy. So if you like that stuff, you'll like seminary. If not, don't go. They're weird. All right, 2 verse 1. Okay, now just pause for a second and remember, okay, Israel's been living in Egypt now 400 years, okay? You've got a Levite who's marrying who? Another Levite. Why would that stick out at you? Priestly line, okay? What hasn't happened yet. From just a Israel, Egyptian standpoint, like why is that significant? Yeah, they're keeping it in the family, right? So there's a sense of national pride. I don't know how much they would have been marrying outside of that anyway, but after 400 years, I bet some occurred. They were slaves, but, you know, so I don't know. But you get the idea that there's some, Moses has got good parents, right, who raised probably him or concerned about their heritage, okay? So let's keep going to verse 2.
And she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months.
Yours says divine child? Fine child. Sorry. I'm like, man, About to ask you what version you're reading out of again if you switched on me. Okay. But yeah, so fine or beautiful. Okay. So obviously, what does she know is coming for her kid? Death, right? So would have been on the birth stool if they could have got to him in time. Now it's going to be thrown into the Nile. Okay. She hides him for 3 months. Anyone tried to like silence a newborn before when they cry and want to be fed? I mean, yeah, Jacob's like wishing he could find the mute switch right on this kid right now. Just sleep from 3 in the morning on, right? Can you imagine how difficult that would have been in the wee hours of the night when the kids are crying? And like how she did it for 3 months, God only knows. But she got to a point where she realizes, this isn't going to work. I can't hide him. And the fact that this would make, think how desperate you are, where verse 3 as a mother would make logical sense. Can you imagine? Like you realize this is the best option for my kid to survive. I'm going to stick him in a basket, waterproof it, push him out into the Nile, and hope for the best. Because if he stays here, he's going to die. I mean, you can imagine how many close calls they've had where, you know, there were probably soldiers that came in her house. I mean, the movie is probably, the Prince of Egypt is probably fairly accurate. And just the sense of the panic and the difficulty and how gut-wrenching that would be. And for that to be an option is, I can't imagine pushing one of my children out, like a 3-month-old child who is, they have nothing. Like they can't turn over, they can't stand up, they can't, you know, if there's water, they're going to drown. I mean, you just think through how incredible that situation is and the faith that this Jochebed would have had to be able to do what she does, right? That's insane. So now, verse 4, here's our first mention of Miriam. This is Moses' older sister. Stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. So she tracks him down and kind of walks the bank of the Nile, and lo and behold, watch how God sovereignly directs this basket. Verse 5.
Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the river bank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies.
All right. So Moses is found by Pharaoh's daughter. So that just interesting aside. This is sometimes at least in the Prince of Egypt, they got that wrong. It was Pharaoh's wife, but it's the daughter of Pharaoh. What do you notice they recognize immediately in verse 6? Clearly a Hebrew kid. So they know who they're dealing with, right? So they know that this is supposed to be a kid that would be put to death, okay? So she finds this kid. Verse 7, his sister's there. Miriam says to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?" Hey, you can't nurse. This kid needs to be nursed. How about I go find a nurse for this kid? And watch what she does. Verse 8, keep going. How about that? So reunited with mom. So the faith that it took to push Moses out into the river and hope for the best, God honors that. So she now gets to see my child is safe. My kid's okay. She gets the mother. Watch what Pharaoh's daughter does in verse 9.
Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me and I will pay you."
So she gets paid to be a mom now, right? So she went from hiding her baby in complete hysteria, trying to cover up the fact that he's there, to now she's being paid to be a wet nurse for this kid. Okay, so we don't always get to see that, right? God doesn't always show us kind of the rest of the story, and we don't always kind of get the backstage pass to what's going on. In this instance, God does that and shows Jochebed her faith and that he honored that, and now she gets to nurse this kid until he's weaned, which again, in this culture, would have been from 2, maybe upwards of 5, but probably 2 years old-ish, and then that kid would have been given into Pharaoh's household, and she would have said, you know, c'est la vie, okay? So, verse 10, the child grew. She was brought to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses, because I drew him out of the water. What does Moses mean? To draw out, okay? So, a double meaning there. One, he was drawn out of the water. What is the other meaning with Moses and to draw out the people, right? So she had no idea what she was really saying when she named this kid. So he's going to draw the people out of Egypt in just a few years, okay? So pretty significant, neat moment. Now, think about this for a second. Why would Pharaoh, this is Pharaoh's daughter who's taking this kid, clearly a Hebrew kid, a son, to be her own boy. Why would Pharaoh okay that? Okay, but yeah, maybe. Maybe he's, you know, wrapped around her finger, you know, daughters and dads. I certainly understand that. Okay, potentially. But why a son? Why would Pharaoh care about a son?
Did he not have any sons?
Potentially. There's people that believe that Pharaoh didn't have a kid, and this would have been the heir to the throne. So think about that. Potentially, Moses was raised with the idea that he would be the next Pharaoh because the current Pharaoh didn't have a son that would follow in his footsteps. So potentially, okay, not for sure, but it's interesting that this guy would allow that to take place, knowing that it's a Hebrew, knowing that it's a Hebrew boy. A Hebrew female wouldn't be near as intimidating, right, to Pharaoh. Again, trying to kill all the kids, and they kept this one. So for whatever it's worth, there you go, okay? There's 40 years. That's the first 40 years of Moses' life. That's all we get, okay? That's the first 40.
I usually get confused in this story, all of the people. So
yep.
There's Pharaoh's sister and daughter there?
No, no, no. Just daughter.
Just daughter.
Yep. Moses' sister, Miriam, okay? So you've got Moses' family. He's the youngest of three. You've got Aaron. You've got Miriam, and then you got Moses, okay? So he's the youngest of the three kids. Jochebed is Moses' mom. We get that in somewhere. I forget where it's mentioned.
She's the one that
pushes him out, okay?
Sister there during that time?
Follows the basket, okay? So she watches Pharaoh's daughter pick up Moses and says, hey, do you want me to get a nurse for that kid? Goes back and tells mom, hey, guess what you get to do? You get to now nurse your son, whom you just put in the Nile, and get paid for it. Yeah, apparently they interacted a ton, and that would have been, so they're not slaves in the sense that, you know, yeah, there's interaction between them, and they still had a life outside of those things. So yeah, that would have been acceptable. So, and this is a kid she's talking to who wouldn't have been out doing hard labor at this point. So yeah. Okay. So it's good. So you guys see the kind of the plot thickening in the story. Okay. So again, we get Moses in the first 40 years of his life. We really don't know much more, okay? We're going to get a little bit in the second 40 years. Basically, 11 to 11 through 25 are the second 40 years of Moses, okay? So Moses' life, by the way, he lives to 120, 40, 40, 40. And it's fascinating that two-thirds of his life is spent in development, and a third of it is spent doing ministry, okay? So God takes this guy, and he's going to put him through a very intentional discipleship process for two-thirds of his life. And then a third of it, he's going to do what he had been doing this whole time, probably unbeknownst to him, as to why God was doing what he's doing. Okay, so think about that for you guys. If you just took a lifespan and said, okay, let's just make it, let's say we're going to live till we're 90, right? Just for a good round number that breaks into thirds, right? Can you imagine the first 60 years of your life just being spent in development, right? Of being trained. And not that you're not doing anything, but the really, like the golden years of your life were the last 30 from 60 to 90, and then you die, right? On top of Mount Nebo and looking into the promised land, right? That's Moses' story. So think about that in terms of how old you are and maybe what God's doing with you. Like, I'm always just astonished at that. I'm like, man, I'm 37, about to be 38, and I think about my life and what I've done or what I haven't, and think, man, I'm still on the front side of the first half of my life, right? And God's still developing me and things. And as I look back on my story and see the things that he did with me that I didn't understand at the time, but makes sense in the rearview mirror, you guys are going to see that as well, right? You're in seasons where you love what you're doing, or you hate what you're doing, or whatever it may be, but it's purposeful, and God's working in you, and those things that he's doing are going to be redemptive at some point, and that's Moses' story. I doubt he knew, to some degree, why God had him doing what he was doing, okay? So let's look at the second half, or the second 40 years of Moses' life, 11 and following, of chapter 2. Someone pick up in verse 11.
One
day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people.
All right, so make some observations for me.
He knows whose people are.
Knows whose people are. So he knows he's not Egyptian, clearly. He knows he's a Hebrew, right? He realizes that, okay? So one day he just goes out and he looks at his brethren and sees the hardship and notices that an Egyptian is beating a Hebrew, right? So he sees that and that raises up something in him, okay? So you almost get the idea in verse 11, maybe Moses has seen this one too many times. This, you don't get the impression this is the first time that he's seen this. It seems to be a habitual thing, potentially just the way that the text reads. He blows his top vertically in verse 12, basically. It seems like this is something that he's gotten fed up with, if you will. He's seen it one too many times, okay? So he sees this. Verse 12, watch what he does.
He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and put him in the sand.
Okay, so what's his answer to said problem? I'm going to kill you, right? So you're dead, right? So now, the issue's much bigger, right? This isn't an Egyptian and a Hebrew. This isn't a bar fight, right? This is a entire people group that is oppressing in another people group. So this doesn't solve the problem, okay? So, but for whatever reason, this is his reaction. He's angry, he's passionate, and he blows his top and does something that we would all say, probably not the best answer, Moses, okay? So he buries this guy in the sand, which, you know, I don't know that that was the smartest move either, right? If you've seen windswept, whatever, like he's not going to stay there long, or hopefully he packed him in the right area of sand, which he would have known something about. So who knows, okay? Hides him in verse 13. Watch what happens.
When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? He answered, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known.
All right, so he comes back the next day after he's done this, which is odd to me, right? Sees the same situation, and now he continues to see this struggle between a Hebrew, or two Hebrews now, an Egyptian, and he has there's something going on inside of him that he asks this question, or he's expecting maybe a different response. What is their response to him? Is it positive or negative? It's negative. Like, who the heck are you, right? Are you a judge over us? Like, what are you doing? So he realizes in verse 14 that they've taken this not in a way that he assumed they would, that surely the matter has become known. Pharaoh hears about it in verse 15. He tries to kill Moses as a result of this. Moses flees and ends up in Midian. Okay? So there's the story. Now, Acts has a different picture of this. And Stephen gives us this one little verse to me that's fascinating as to what Moses was doing. Okay? And I've got a theory. Okay? Turn to Acts 7, okay? Don't bet your life on this. It's a theory, but I think there's good evidence in the text that shows us something was going on in Moses' head that Exodus maybe doesn't, it keeps in the shadows a little bit, that Stephen's going to bring out, okay? Thank God for Stephen, dude. He gives some great Old Testament history on his deathbed, right? And it also gives us a little bit insight into Moses' birth, okay? 7 verse 20, okay? It was at that time that Moses was born. He was leveling the sight of God. He was nurtured 3 months in his father's house. Okay, we've seen all this. Verse 21, he had been set outside. Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. Okay, so all of that is in Exodus, right? 22, you get a little bit of a nugget here on something that's different. What does 22 say?
Moses was educated all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action.
Okay, now paint a picture for me. You are Pharaoh's daughter's son. Okay? So you are Pharaoh's grandson. Tell me about what type of life you have.
Baller,
right? Anything and everything, right? How were you educated? Everything. You got Harvard, you got Yale, okay? He had it all. Especially if he's the next Pharaoh in line, he would have been schooled in everything. Chuck Swindoll talks about that in all the learning of the Egyptians is almost a colloquialism to say, listen, he got it all, right? He had a silver spoon in his mouth. He got astrology. He got astronomy. He got Egyptian history and culture. He got music and arts and This guy's a Princeton graduate when it's all done, okay? He knows everything. He knows all about his people. He would have gotten a fantastic education. He certainly knew his stuff, okay? So that's the idea.
I feel like it doesn't make sense that he knows he's Hebrew then. Like, I feel like they would keep him.
Isn't that bizarre? So I don't know why. Maybe it's one of those, like, adoptive parent things where you're like, we need to tell our kid who he is. So, again, he would have looked similar, so I don't think it would have been like, wait, you're black and I'm white. Like, what? Something's off, right? They all look the same. Dark skin, dark eyes, dark hair. They would have looked similar enough where they probably wouldn't distinguish each other. So you get the idea that they told him or, you know, whatever. So, but he knows for whatever reason, okay? And not only does he know, but what do you notice in Moses with that? Does he care about that? He feels very much a sense of, like, that's my people. Like, that's my identity. So it's not just, oh, okay, cool, great, give me my silver spoon again, right? He feels a sense of, there's this tension in his life, which is very common for birth children that realize, man, I was adopted, and now which world do I belong in? Like, who are my parents, and how do I reconcile that? Like, I have an affection for both, right? So that can be hard, especially in this group. We know a lot about that. Okay, so that's the idea, okay? Powerful in words and deeds. Now, why is that fascinating? Moses was a man powerful in words and deeds.
He didn't think so,
right? What's God going to ask him to do? Go public speak for a living. And Moses says, uh-uh. Like, that is, you got the wrong dude. Well, according to this, he could speak, right? So, many believe that Moses potentially had a stuttering issue. Maybe that's why he was insecure about wanting to speak publicly. I don't know. It's all conjecture. But you get the idea that he was at least educated in that. He had the know-how. He knew how to write an introductory sentence with three, you know, body paragraphs and a conclusion. And, you know, right, he could get up and deliver a speech.
Could it be that he's speaking to his people and then maybe against the people that, you know, that raised him? Because, like, just in my example, when, you know, to go speak, people,
mm-hmm.
I'm scared as heck, you know, like, so, I don't know, so could that be it?
Like, potentially. It seems like he's not afraid to step up in that moment and kill a Hebrew, or kill an Egyptian who's beating a Hebrew and kind of beat his chest and say, and again, as we look through the text, I just want you guys to see a couple things. It seems like he, I don't want to tell you, let's keep going. I want you guys to have the aha for yourself, okay? 23, as he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. Again, why? Why did it enter his mind? Okay, keep going. 24, someone read that.
He saw one of them being mistreated by an Egyptian, so he went to his defense and avenged him by killing the Egyptian.
So what has he seen for 40 years of his life? His people oppressed, right? This moment was the straw that broke the camel's back, and he's like, I am done, okay? It entered his mind, okay, again, why? Why did it enter his mind to do that, okay? 25, he kills this Egyptian, right? He comes back the next day. 25, this is fascinating to me. Read that. Where would Moses have gotten that idea? Now, we read this in hindsight and go, of course, that's exactly what God's going to do. He's going to use you to deliver the people. We know how Exodus ends. It's no great mystery. Why, at 40 years old, would Moses think, this is what I'm supposed to do?
So he had a connection with God then?
Would that be typical? Has God spoken to anybody in the past through dreams and saying, you're going to do this, I'm going to have you do that? What's the problem here then? So, potentially, God has told Moses, I'm going to use you. You are going to deliver this people out of Egypt. I'm assuming. So, what's the issue? What does Moses do?
I think it was like the wrong, like right thoughts, but like wrong action.
Absolutely. It's the right thing at the wrong time. Moses goes out and says, great, this is my job. Fantastic. Kills a guy, realizes, okay, overreacted, let's bury him, comes out the next day and says, follow me, right? And everybody goes, are you a judge over us? Who the heck are you? And he went, oh, crap, like, that's not how this was supposed to go. God told me he was going to deliver me and use me to deliver the people, right? So you get the idea that he had in him this knowledge that God was going to use him, but it was the wrong timing. God wasn't ready. What has Moses not had? 40 years of desert training. He's not ready. He's a little bit arrogant, a little presumptuous, a little ready, fire, aim, like Peter, right? You know, jump out of the boat, and, oh God, what did I just do? Okay, you know, uh-oh, you know, help. So you kind of get the idea that Moses had some understanding of this. Stephen writes it in such a way that in 25, you see him say, it seemed to Moses that this is how the people should have reacted, but they didn't, and he can't figure that out, okay? So God says, well, yeah, you jumped the gun on my timing, right? I wasn't ready to do that yet, right? Now, take a step back. Does that ever happen to us? Apply that to our lives. You guys ever seen that? It's God's will, and you know that's the right thing. It's godly, but God doesn't open that door yet, and we just beat it down, and at times God will let us walk through it and go, okay, right? You guys been there? Have you felt that? It's fascinating to me. Like, and often I would imagine Moses probably didn't realize what he was in for. It looked like the first 40 years of his life, the second 40 years of his life were great, right? The first 80 were awesome. The last 40 are going to be difficult, and the 40 in between when he's living out in the middle of nowhere, I should say, in Midian, are hard. He's a nobody. He went from potentially the next Pharaoh to forgotten in 24 hours, gone. Wanted to be killed by his grandfather, right? So keep that in mind, which just is life and stuff. Moses is an encouragement to me because I would describe Moses and say, that's his holy discontent, right? He sees suffering and affliction of his people, and he has to move. He has to act. He feels compelled to do something. He doesn't do it at the right time, but you see in him there's a stirring that he can't let go of. And from a guy whose life was changed because of a holy discontent, I appreciate that with Moses. But God was not ready to open the door for him to go down that path, right? We all have those. You guys have those stirrings in you as well. Moses, we would say, is maybe social injustice or his people being oppressed or however you want to paint that. We all have various different things that just absolutely wreck us, right? And to someone else, that may be I'm aware of it. I read about it on the news, but man, it doesn't keep me up at night. But for you, it is not a suggestion from God. It's a mandate, right? Some of you, man, you may not have that yet, right? God may be stirring in you. You may be in the first third of your life where you're learning and being educated and whatever, and God is going to reveal to you one day that he's going to show you a situation and you're going to just get wrecked over it, right? And you have no idea. It came out of left field and all of a sudden you can't put it down, okay? So wherever you guys are at in the journey, remember that. It took Moses 40 years to even figure out what that was. He figures it out and then he jumps the gun and God says, I'm not done with you. And I think Moses is going to have a sense that he completely blew it. I think when we see his response to God, it's the idea of, listen, I tried and I failed horribly. It was train wreck awful. And now I am cleaning up sheep poo in the wilderness. Like, that's my job for my father-in-law who's a Midianite. Nobody knows who I am. And you want to use me? God, you got the wrong guy. I am a failure. And I think that's how Moses felt about himself when God says, no, you're the guy. Now you're ready. Yeah, think about that. Like, if your grandson, hypothetically, right, if he did something to this level, what would your first response be probably as a grandparent? Probably to protect, right, or to try to figure out a way out. That is not Pharaoh's response at all, right? I did find that fascinating as I was reading that. Maybe. So maybe something's changed. Maybe it was one of those things where he was like, great, she wants that, let her have it, you know. So who knows, but you don't get the impression that Pharaoh is, he's not real flexible with this. So yeah, for whatever reason, that does strike me as odd. So maybe an error came, maybe he was just being, you know, it was like, whatever, 40 years ago I let that happen and I shouldn't have. So, nope. Yeah, maybe he sees what's coming. Yeah, Like, okay, you've picked sides, and maybe he even has an inkling of an idea of, like, he knows that Moses knows that he's a Hebrew. He probably sees that stirring and that discontent in him of, you know, who am I? Where do I fit? Maybe he's like, okay, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. You've basically turned the back on your family, and we're now turning our back on you. Did you have a thought, Jane? We don't get a ton. This is really, that's it. So this piece in Acts, and then obviously through the journey throughout the Old Testament. But no, we don't get a description of his.
I was wondering, because you know how, was it Joseph? Yeah, Joseph, you know how he was like, you know, tall. You know, so Moses is that kind of guy, but he, you know, maybe he was like. You know,
we see that he's beautiful as a baby.
Yeah.
Past that, nope. Or, yeah, he's divine. So many thoughts in my head. They're all going to stay in my head. Yes. Yeah, I think because he had that burden, I think, and that God maybe had revealed to him already what he was going to do, that he was like, well, maybe this is the time. So he goes out to see the people, and he's like, oh, here's the situation right here, right? So, and again, he overreacts, but I think he was trying to put the pieces together himself and just jumps the gun. So yeah, I think that's exactly why he feels compelled to go visit his people. So, yep. Cool, makes sense? Okay, so that's my understanding of Moses, okay? So he's a guy with a holy discontent and jumps the gun. I really do think that he feels like my life is a miserable failure and is done, okay? So, again, he goes from, back to Exodus 3, or 2, rather, he goes from palace to Midian in a verse, right? So that's obviously a pretty long, arduous journey, as you guys saw that. You just don't cut across the Sinai Peninsula. You would have had to dip south all the way down and hug the ocean down there, and then over into Midian. So that was a very lengthy journey. So you can imagine how he would have felt running out of town. And he didn't get to pack bags and take all that he needed. He left in a hurry.
Sorry. I had another cross-reference to Hebrews 11.
Mm-hmm.
In 11:24, that said, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter.
Hmm.
So, like, kind of, even though he...
Interesting.
Egyptian, like, he kind of made his...
Huh. Okay. That's I didn't know that was there. That's good. Some insight as well. So, yeah, maybe that's why Pharaoh responded the way he did. So it's good. So he winds up in Midian, sits down at a well. Okay, again. So in that day and age, man, wells were everything. Water is everything. When you're traveling in the desert, you can imagine why he ends up there. 16. Let's pick up there. 2 verse 16. Okay, now what do you see even in that in Moses? What do you see there? The shepherds came and drove them away, these women who came to water their flock. Moses helped them and watered their flock. Why does he care? Women come trying to water their flock. The male shepherds come in and run them off. He stands up to the male shepherds and says, "What the heck?" and helps them. Why?
He has a heart for the oppressed.
Do you see the theme in his discontent? I have a heart for the oppressed. I have a heart for the people that are not being treated fairly. That's not right. Like you can see him banging his finger and saying, as a persister, that's not okay, right? And it doesn't matter if it's his people or if it's people that aren't his people, right? That he doesn't know, you know, Midianites from Edomites from whatever other ites. He doesn't have any connection to them. He cares about that issue. So you see that even in that. And in the midst of, like, who needs to be helped at this point? Moses, right? Like he's down and out and probably not in a really good way right now, and yet that passion is that strong in him where he has to act, okay? So, again, fascinating about him, okay? Verse 18, they came to Reuel. This is Jethro, by the way. We see him named two different things in Scripture, but this is Jethro, who obviously is going to play a very significant role. This is his adoptive father, if you will, right? Moses is going to see, he's going to learn a ton from him. He's going to have a profound respect for him. Jethro's going to come to him later and offer him some phenomenal advice. So he's going to be a key figure, obviously, in Moses' life. So were you scratching your... Go ahead. Not that you asked. Yep. Yeah, so the Midianites were from one of Abraham's other wives, Keturah, is that her name? So they come from that deal. So they didn't worship Yahweh. So he would have been a guy that was a religious figure in his community, but not of Yahweh. Okay, so it seems like, we'll see what happens to Jethro later on. Okay, but it seems like he learns about the God of Moses and worships him. But at this point, most definitely not Yahweh. So, okay. And again, desert-dwelling people, okay, in the middle of nowhere. So God brings him into, you know, literally nowhere, okay? So they ask him, hey, why have you come back so soon in verse 18? And they said, hey, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And what is more, he even drew water for us out and watered our flock. Verse 20, he said to his daughters, where is he then? Why have you left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat, okay? 21, Moses was willing to dwell with this man, and he gave him his daughter Zipporah as a wife. Okay, so he marries. This is how, obviously, Moses Jethro becomes Moses' father-in-law. He marries Zipporah, a Midianite woman. Okay, so they rescue him. So Moses is in the desert, in the Midbar, if you will. One of the three words we have for desert in the Old Testament, one of them is Midbar. The root of that word means to speak. Okay, it's kind of fascinating because this is where God is going to end up speaking to Moses, okay? So interesting play on words. As you kind of imagine this area of Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula, we have a great example of this. I want you guys to think Mojave, okay? It's not Sahara, where it is miles and miles of sand dunes, okay? That's not the desert they're in. They are in the rocky, hot, there's obviously some sand there, but it's mostly this rocky terrain that's very difficult to navigate and just hot, right? Sun scorched stuff, baking, right? I remember the first time I drove from Needles up through Bakersfield. We were moving one of a pastoral staff out here, and the AC went out in our U-Haul, and I'm driving through this thing going like 45 miles an hour as the RPMs are pegged in this U-Haul trying not to die. And I'm asking Brad, I'm like, what are all those spots on the side of the road? And he's like, oh, those were cars blew up, right? You see these rectangular areas that are just scorched concrete. Like, oh yeah, that's where a car overheated and caught on fire, right? So that's where Moses is, okay? He's in Midian, and it's just that type of terrain. And he has to shepherd sheep out there. We're going to find out that's his job. So he's going to work for Jethro, and he's going to be a shepherd of sheep out in the desert, okay? So again, not an easy job, not an easy place to be, but you talk about lots of quiet time and time to hang out with God and whatever, like Moses had it. So get off me. Sent the fly over here. Go back to Jessica. All right. So they have a kid. Name him Gershom. Okay. In verse 23, it came about in the course of many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage. They cried out, and the cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. Okay. 24, God heard their groanings. God remembered his covenant to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Okay. Again, 480 years later, God says, I have not forgotten you. I predicted way back in Genesis 15 that you would be afflicted for 400 years. You guys remember that text? Right before God sends Abraham through the passing of the parts, he says, you're basically going to get spanked for 400 years by a country that is not your own. And God says, I have not forgotten you. Okay. 25, God saw the sons of Israel and God took notice of them. So he cares. He knows exactly what they're going through, but he brought them through this for a reason, okay? 3, verse 1, now we're going to see, this is the last 80 years of Moses' life. So from here to the end of Deuteronomy, this is the last 40 years. So Moses is 80 years old, and now we're going to see what God has been doing with him in the middle of nowhere.
So when it says that God remembered, because it comes up often in the Bible,
yeah.
It's like he never actually forgot.
Correct.
What does that mean?
It's the idea that... God is now going to be stirred to action. So, yeah, he didn't forget, but he's saying, now I'm going to do something about this. Now the timing is right, okay? So again, 40 years in the palace. He's now spent 40 years in the desert, okay? And that's his job, right? He is a shepherd of a lowly little flock of a guy from Midian. Got a wife, got a kid, that's his life, okay? So, again, just we roll through 11 through 25. That's 40 years of Moses' life. And at this point in his life, literally, I think he feels like, God, I tried, that didn't work. I guess I'm going to shepherd sheep. This is an okay lifestyle. You know, I know where to get water. This is kind of my life. So, great. Mm-hmm.
And then in chapter 3, verse 1, it says his name is Jethro.
Yeah, so either one. You see it go back and forth in Scripture. Okay, so Reuel, Raul, however you say that. We'll call him Jethro because I can say that. The other one's too hard. Okay? All right, 3, verse 1. Pick up there.
Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God.
Okay, so where is he at? West side? West side? East side? Right? Okay, what mountain?
Horeb.
Horeb. Anybody got a note on Horeb? What else is that called in Scripture? Mount of God or Mount Sinai. Okay, same thing. Okay, so it's odd to me if Moses, again, I don't have the map up. If Moses is in Midian, to pasture your flock on the west side would have meant he would have gone around that little peninsula of water and have been in the Sinai Peninsula as opposed to in, so your side, Midian over here, deal, and then he would have been over on the other side. It's possible that Mount Sinai was actually in Midian, right? So potentially. Now, it could be in the Sinai Peninsula west of that, which he is certainly on the west side, but he is far from home at this point, pasturing his flock. So, that tells you either he, water and food were so scarce that he had to travel that far to feed his flock, or maybe Mount Horeb is actually, or Mount Sinai is a little bit closer to Midian than maybe some of us would have guessed. So again, there's 20 plus locations out there as to where they think it is. But regardless, here he is. This would have been a place that he was familiar with, right? Mountain of God, Mount Horeb, he's there, he's feeding his flock. So God has now spent these 40 years discipling Moses, okay, for what he's about to do, okay? Now, watch what happens, verse 2.
The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of the bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight. Why the bush is not burned up?
Okay, now, think about this for a second. You're in a desert, it's hot, stuff is dry. Do you think this is the first burning bush that Moses has ever seen? Probably not, right? Stuff catches on fire, it's hot, whatever, gets hit with lightning, I don't know. But this is probably not an odd thing, okay? What does Moses notice about it that is odd? It's not burning up. It's on fire and staying on fire, okay? So he says, I gotta kind of look at this, okay? So he pulls himself aside and recognizes something about this, okay? Again, he's got a lot of spare time, right? A lot of... Wow, like this is my action for the day, right? A burning bush, right? So you can imagine that life is pretty boring out in Midian when this is the, yeah, woohoo! So this is his fireworks, right?
Talking to a sheep when he says, I
would have been exactly. That's all he's got, right? So yeah, apparently.
Like that volleyball.
Yeah, it's Wilson. This is Wilson. Absolutely. Nicely done, Pete. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think he's probably talking to himself because that's his audience at this point, right? Right. So again, verse 2, who do you notice shows up?
The angel
of the Lord. Haven't seen him in a while, but here he is again. Okay, verse 4, when the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush. You guys see, by the way, the Lord, the angel of the Lord, like, it's very assumptive that it's the same person. It goes back and forth, right? Called to him from the midst of the bush and says, Moses, Moses, why? Again, twice. Why is repeating twice significant? A name?
Reaffirms that,
but even more so. It's a term of, it's affection, okay? It's like sweetheart, honey, not in a weird way, but it's like Abraham, Abraham. Now that I see that you're not going to kill your kid, like, I know you, we are intimate, okay? We have, you know, it's that, so Moses, Moses is the idea of I know who you are. Moses says, here I am, right? So that had to be weird. So out of a bush that's not caught on fire. He says now, verse 5, keep going there.
Then he said, do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He also said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God.
Okay, so has this crazy interaction with God, right? Takes his sandals off. God reminds him of who he is, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which he hasn't mentioned in almost 500 years. Moses knows that and would have known his history and his people, so he knows this is significant. And God tells him, look, I've seen the affliction of your people, verse 7, or of my people who are in Egypt. I've given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters. I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down, verse 8, to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, to bring them up to the land, to a good spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. So these are all the squatters living in the land currently. Okay. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. So there's God's plan. So 80 years, this is what now God has had in store for him the whole time.
Back to verse 6 where Moses hid his face and it says that he was afraid to look at God. What, like, he's looking at the burning bush. Did it change? Like, why does it say he was looking at God? And I mean, I feel like something transformed for him to then hide his face.
I think he has a realization of who he's speaking to, and in that moment, that was significant enough. You can't see God. We see consistently in the Old Testament that because of his holiness and in our not, that there would be death. But you get the same reaction of everybody when they realize they're standing in the presence of God, which is what?
Fear.
Fear. And it's not a, this is a good distinction to make. This isn't a, I am afraid of you in the sense that I'm afraid. It's a, I am in awe, I am awestruck, I am fearful of your magnificence and my lack thereof. So that's the response. So he is humbled and on his face. So
in Exodus later on that there's a part, I don't know if it's Moses specifically, but where there's another time where he's in the presence of the Lord and he says he has to turn his back so he doesn't see him.
He's on Sinai. I think the story you're thinking of is with Elijah in the mountaintop, and God comes by, and he sees, he has his back to him, and it says that he sees God's back, basically. Yeah. So, same idea. So, God covers his face. We can't see him, and he passes by to, so, another story for another day, but we'll get there, but yeah. So, but we see several, I mean, you see Isaiah, who's wrecked in the presence of God. You see the patriarchs that have all been there. They just feel a sense of, like, I should die right now, right? And it's a consistent reaction from everyone. So kind of cool, okay? So.
What's the significance of, like, taking off your shoes?
I don't know. It's kind of weird, isn't it? So just the idea that I think what he's about to be called to is significant and holy. This isn't an everyday moment, I guess. So, but why the shoes off, I don't know. So anybody got, do they? Mm-hmm. I'm looking for Raven, who knows our Muslim culture, and she's not here. So, dang it, call her. Yeah, they certainly do. I don't know if that's it all linked to this. So.
Well, they don't really like wash people's feet and stuff because they get so dirty when they're traveling.
For sure.
It might be like a symbol.
Maybe it's side of that. Yeah, these people have some dirty feet. That much I know. So, yep. All right, now, God tells them in verse 10, this is my plan for you. This is Moses' answer, okay? You're going to see this four times for Moses. This is excuse one of four. Okay, so God literally is going to have to ask him repeatedly to do this task in verse 10. And here's his first answer, verse 11.
But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?
Okay, so what's he say?
I'm a nobody,
right? Who am I, right? Now, given the Moses that we saw 40 years ago, what do you feel like's changed in him? Yeah, you see a humility about him, right? Do you think 40 years of being a nobody will do that to you? Right? I think that's part of what God had for him is he wasn't ready to lead because he hadn't been in the desert. He hadn't been a nobody, right? He hadn't shepherded sheep. So he literally sees himself as like, I am a nobody, right? I'm nothing. Like, God, you missed your opportunity. When I was somebody, I could have done something. But I tried and failed. Now I'm a nobody. God, you have this all backwards. And God says, no, Moses, you have it backwards. I can't use you until you're broken and humble and empty. And then when you're at that point, now I can use you.
It's interesting because from verse 6 through 10, God says, I am, I have, I know, I have, I will. And then Moses answers back, who am I?
Yeah, right.
So God's telling him, I, you know. And and it just made me think how many times God tells us to do something. And I think about myself.
Pete, that's a great observation. So good hermeneutics. That's exactly right, though, right? He'll do that again. We'll see that theme with Moses is God will have to repeat to him who he is. But yeah, our tendencies are all that way, right? Well, what about me? And I don't. And God's like, yes, you don't. That's exactly right. And because you don't, I will and I can. So, but you see, I think what I like about it is you see a humility in him. Moses is going to be recorded in Scripture as being the most humble guy that's ever existed. Now, he also wrote that, so figure that out. I don't get it, but it's in parentheses, so I don't know. Maybe God wrote that while he put Moses to sleep or something. I don't know. But you see a real humility about Moses that I like, and I go, okay, you get it. Okay, so excuse one is like, who am I? How can you use a nobody like me, right? Certainly I will be with you, God says in verse 12, and thus shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought your people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Okay, so you're going to come back here, Mount Horeb, and you're going to worship me right where we're standing right now at this burning bush. Okay, so here comes now excuse two. Read that. 13. All right, so this is a fair enough question, right? These people worship a gazillion gods. I know you, but they don't know you. So when I say God, are we talking about Ra? Are we talking about Hepi? Are we talking about Pharaoh who thinks he's a god? Like, who are we talking about, okay? So we're now going to get an explanation about who Yahweh is like we have never seen before, okay? In chapter 2 of Genesis, we see this name used for the first time. This is the first time God's going to say, let me tell you who I am, okay? And this is, it's a really cool, and even as God says it, it almost gets more confusing, but that's kind of the idea, okay? So verse 14, this is his answer.
God says to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, speak to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you.
Okay, you tell him, I am sent you. You're like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, Moses was wanting a name, right? Tell them, Thor, the God of Thunder, or whatever. I don't know. But he wasn't looking for that, right? I am who I am, right? Sent you. Like, show them that you're a more powerful God than them with your name or whatever. I'm assuming is what Moses was trying to find in context. And God says, tell them I am sent you. Why is that significant? What is the root word of Yahweh? Do you guys know where that comes from? It's from the word, or from the verb, to be. That's what it means, okay? So, to be, the idea is present, the idea is, you know, that's who I am, okay? Rob Bell, before he went, like, totally heretical, had an interesting observation on this. So, you can tell Rob I said that. He doesn't like me anyway. He doesn't know who I am, so that's all right. Yeah, he's not talking about me in sermons. Yeah, so, he had an interesting just observation about this. So, in Hebrew, there are no verbs. No vowels, not verbs. They have verbs. They don't have vowels, okay? So when you read Hebrew, you read it from left to right. Sorry, right to left like Chinese, okay? Not left to right like us. You have to understand the language enough to know where words end and begin and how to put them together, okay? So they're just consonants, okay? You'll see in even some of our like language tools, they'll put like little dots or markings above letters to let you know for us like, non-Hebrews, like how to pronounce stuff and where the vowel should go and where the sound should go. So he basically says, as this is written in Hebrew, it's four letters, yod, he, vav, he. Okay, so it's not that that's important, but it's four letters what makes up the word Lord, or I am who I am. It's the closest sounds that they would have in Hebrew to vowels. And he basically says, when God utters his name, it's almost impronounceable. Like it's just a bunch of vowels stuck together, right? Like you would look at it and go, A, E, O, U. What is that? Like, he gives him this answer that, like, it's more confusing than had he not asked in the first place, right? Some people, Rob suggests, and I don't know how much evidence there is of this, would say that the word Yahweh would have been, when you said each individual letter, yod, he, vav, he, it would have been like breathing. So God is almost, in a sense, saying, when you say my name, you're breathing, you are proving my existence. That is who I am. Yod, hey, vav, hey. You just proved who I am. So and I thought, that's interesting. So I don't know if it's right or not. But the idea is, it doesn't give Moses a ton of help, right? His name is almost impronounceable, and it means to be. So basically, God is telling him, I am who I am. I have always been. I am eternal. I am. And that's the best explanation that he can give to us as to who he is. So it's interesting that that's the idea. That and he'll go on in verse 15 to kind of elaborate on that. Okay. Furthermore, God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever. This is my memorial name to all generations. This is how I will be remembered. I am the Lord, Yahweh. Okay, so kind of a cool, like that's who he is. Okay. Go, gather the elders of Israel together, verse 16. Say to them, the Lord, the God of the fathers of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has appeared to me. I am indeed concerned about you and what you have done, what has been done to you in Egypt. Okay, so that's God's answer now to Moses. So he gives an excuse and says, number one, who am I that you should send me? And then his next excuse is what? Who are you, right? So he at least asked the right question at this point, right? You said, I. Well, who is I? Who do I tell them that you are?
Did they have, it was pretty organized to have elders? Like, so they were in slavery, but...
Yeah, but they were, correct. They would have had some sense of community and structure and lived separate from them. So yeah, they've got some sense of, yeah, community and family structure, what have you. Yeah, I think he would have learned about it growing up. You see that's important to him growing up as to who he is. So, I'm sure he would have found out about it and known his people and who they worshipped. I don't know the significance of this for Moses. Was this like a conversion experience? Was this where he really learns, okay, got it? I don't know. But yeah, he has some sense of who God is before this. And maybe this is the moment where he's like, okay, now... it's all coming together. But according to Acts 7, it looks like God spoke to him before, so there's some type of, there's something there. I just don't know to what degree that is. So, but certainly at this point, this is a pretty significant turning point.
I find it interesting as we talk a lot about God's name, and just that I always think back to when Jacob was wrestling and he asked him, what's your name? And he's like, my name is too wonderful. Mm-hmm. You don't get to know my name.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that would have been Mm-hmm. And then finally God's like, you know what, you guys want to know my name, you can't know it, so
yep.
The best thing I can
yep.
do for you is to say, I am God who I am.
Yep.
Yep. I'll give you a description,
yeah.
You can't know my name,
yep.
but
yep.
I am God.
And then he describes who he is, isn't that fascinating? Like that's the best, and he'll do it again in Exodus, but God says to here, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am the God that remembers, I am the God that cares, I am the God that's going to deliver. Like he pictorially represents who he is and in his character, right, and his actions and what he's about to do. So, yeah, that's a great observation.
I don't know if anybody's ever read the Inheritance series, Aragon Ellis. It's like four books in the series, but throughout that entire book series, it's a picture that's helped me a lot, is that there's an idea, it's a science fiction type of thing, but everybody in that book has their name, which people talk about, and
mm-hmm.
different language, like the language of truth or whatever, they have their true name.
Hmm.
And so I've always, that's always helped me of like, Yahweh is how God is allowing people to kind of see him in a mm-hmm. sense, but you can't ever actually know what his truth mm-hmm. is.
That's good. Yeah. And I'm sorry.
It goes back to talk about in Genesis during creation, when God names, it's the authority over that. There's ownership there. Mm-hmm. So where if we really knew his name or we used his name, he's like, you're not going to have authority over me.
Right.
Could it go back to that idea?
Yeah, I think to some degree, for sure. You know, certainly God wants to, he wants us to know who he is. So I don't know how far
right.
to take that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly that the naming idea is that's very clear.
Like we can own or possess God in the sense
we have authority to name him. Yeah. I think for me, it's just like, man, how do you explain to a cockroach who a human is? Like, I can't, you cannot comprehend. You have a brain. It's just way smaller than mine. I cannot articulate, and that's the picture. And that's a horrible picture because the distance between us and God is, you know what I mean? So he's like, listen, you do not have the capacity to get who I am. So I will whittle this down to the lowest common denominator I can to help you understand. And even in that, I'm having to, right? Like, that's not, you don't get it. So, and that's, I think that's where Moses is having a bit of an aha. And where we go, okay. So, anyway, so significant nonetheless, right? So, two excuses so far. We'll stop there this morning, and we'll see more excuses from Moses tomorrow. Yeah, there you are, my friends. Now you know who to pray to. That God right there. I am.